Analysts say the device explosions in Lebanon were sophisticated and must have been well planned.
And then to get those into the hands of your enemy, and it's a pretty, this is not an easy thing to do. They had to have had help. They had to have people on the inside.
Plus, as cold weather approaches, the EU plans to use frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine's depleted energy grid.
Because it is only right that Russia pays for the destruction it caused.
And later, Intel reports on Iranian hackers' efforts to influence the upcoming U.S. election. Voting begins in Kashmir, and a South African study shows promise for treating drug-resistant TB.
Today is Thursday, September 19th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Lori London with Steve Karish. That's the sound of Israeli warplanes flying over Beirut and dropping flares on Thursday, shortly before breaking the sound barrier, and at the same time as Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah was delivering a televised speech from an unknown location. Nasrallah said that Israel has violated red lines when it detonated thousands of pagers across the country. At least 37 people were killed and more than 3,000 wounded when first pagers, then walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah members, exploded in two waves of attacks on Tuesday and Wednesday. Hezbollah's Nasrallah vowed revenge, and Iran says that Israel can expect a crushing response from the axis of resistance.
Hezbollah fired a new barrage into northern Israel on Thursday. It's continuing its exchanges with the Israeli military as fears of a greater war rise. And they're reacting to the attack on the electronic devices used by Hezbollah. Lebanese Health Minister Firas Abiad said those who perpetrated the attacks had no regard for innocent civilians.
This is an act of aggression against non-combatants, community people. Even if some of them are combatants, but this is a non-discriminatory act of attack.
For more on the story, Lori spoke with Jamil Jaffer. He's founder and executive director of the National Security Institute at George Mason University about the device explosions.
Well, Lori, look, I mean, you know, Hezbollah has been attacking civilians in Israel now for months on end with regular missile strikes. We've seen some pretty nasty examples, the playground with children were killed and the like. And so it's not surprising if you're going to be a member of a well-known terrorist group, one that's been on the U.S. foreign terrorist organization list since as long as it's been around. You can't be surprised if your adversary, in this case Israel, conducts an attack on you. And in this case, they conducted a successful attack by first detonating pagers that were in these guys' pockets, or at least they made them ring and they pulled them out and detonated them, and then walkie-talkies to follow. A pretty sophisticated operation in the sense that getting these into the hands of the Hezbollah operatives and then causing them to explode while they're in their hands simultaneously is a pretty neat trick if you can pull it off.
How much time would it take to sort of plan something like this that was so covert that doesn't appear that anyone really expected this?
Well, look, I mean, it obviously takes a long time to, figure out what kind of devices they're going to buy, to then load them up with the explosives in the right form factor that's going to make a difference, but also be able to pack in that small form factor. And then to get those into the hands of your enemy. I mean, this is not an easy thing to do. They had to have had help. They had to have people on the inside to know. I mean, you know, Hezbollah only recently made this switch away from cell phones to pagers, and only a handful of folks, these walkie-talkies, or maybe not a handful, but, you know, less folks than the pagers. So getting these ready to go, getting them into the hands of the people that get them into the hands of the operatives, and pulling it off without being detected, it's a pretty good effort if you can pull it off.
In other words, this was well thought out and planned for quite a while.
I think that's right. I mean, it's not clear that it was planned for quite a while because my sense is that they made the change pretty recently. So they may have had a short period of time, but a pretty well thought out, well executed operation because they weren't detected. They pulled it off successfully, and they took out a number of their adversaries in the process.
But a lot of civilians were also injured. This continues back and forth with more and more civilians getting caught in the crossfire. And now, of course, Hezbollah is vowing retaliation. Where does this end?
Well, look, I mean, civilian deaths are always an unfortunate situation, deeply unfortunate situation when a war is going on. But, you know, Hezbollah hides among civilians. This is how they operate. They don't wear uniforms. And so anytime you try and take out a terrorist operative that hides among civilians, you're going to risk the potential casualties. In this case, these were small explosives built into small devices designed to take out the person who's carrying them. If they happen to be around other people, it's pretty unavoidable, but if you're going to simultaneously detonate hundreds or dozens of these devices, inevitably you're going to have some civilian casualties. And look, at the end of the day, it's hard to know where this ends, but, Hezbollah has an easy way of ending this. They could stop attacking civilians in the north. I mean, they're the ones launching direct rocket attacks on civilians. In this case, this is the idea of going after military personnel, actual terrorist group members. So those were crossfire because Hezbollah, they're shooting at civilians.
Israel's defense minister now declaring a new phase of the war. We had already heard that they were planning on widening their focus toward the northern front against Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Would you say this is the start of that? And what are the risks of this turning into a broader regional conflict, which many officials are concerned about?
Look, if you want to, you always want to try and avoid a two-front war if you can, particularly when you're fighting two groups that are well-armed and have a lot of capabilities. Obviously, Hamas has successfully been, their military wing has been dismantled pretty effectively. You still have lots of terrorist groups and the like, or terrorist cadre running around, but their military operations have been well taken out. Now we're thinking about Hezbollah in the north, and really the reason there's a war going there is because Hezbollah continues to attack civilian locations, and the second they stop doing that, I think this war can tamp down. But the truth is, Lori, behind all of this, both the Hamas funding and Hezbollah as a proxy force, is Iran. And so there's no real widening of the war in the sense that Iran is already engaged in this war. They're just doing it through proxies. And really, the truth is, if Iran is to be stopped, they're going to have to feel the pain of these conflicts.
Jamil Jaffer, founder and executive director of the National Security Institute, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lori.
In the wake of Tuesday's surprising attack on Hezbollah's communications equipment, the manufacturer of the pagers that exploded is denying culpability. Reuters' Sean Hogan has the latest on that.
Japanese radio equipment maker ICOM said Thursday that it was looking into reports that two-way radio devices bearing its logo have exploded in Lebanon. Handheld radios used by armed group Hezbollah detonated on Wednesday across Lebanon's south, just one day after similar explosions of the group's pagers. Lebanon's health ministry said 20 people were killed and 450 injured on Wednesday in Beirut's suburbs and the Bekaa Valley. The death toll from Tuesday's explosions rose to 12, with nearly 3,000 injured. Reuters was able to obtain a model of the handheld radio, said to have been used in Wednesday's attack, known as the ICV-8-2. In this video of Reuters' disassembly of the device, ICOM branding and Made in Japan labels are clearly visible. ICOM said it was not possible to confirm whether the radio product, reportedly related to the explosions, was shipped by the company. Sales of the device were reportedly discontinued about 10 years ago. ICOM said the batteries required to operate the device had also been discontinued. The company added that its products exported overseas undergo strict regulatory processes set by the Japanese government. ICOM has previously warned about counterfeit versions of its devices circulating in the market, especially discontinued models.
Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting for us today.
Moving on to the conflict in Europe, Russian missile strikes overnight Wednesday in Ukraine's Sumy region killed three people and temporarily knocked out power. Kremlin forces have been pummeling Ukraine's energy system in the Sumy region with multiple strikes just this week. As the temperatures drop, the European Union announced Thursday it will provide Ukraine with about $180 million in energy funding ahead of what promises to be a tough winter after continuous Russian attacks on the nation's energy grid.
This includes 60 million euros in humanitarian aid for shelters and heaters, for example, and it includes around 100 million euros for repair works and renewables, and these 100 million euros come from the proceeds of the immobilized Russian assets in the European Union. Because it is only right that Russia pays for the destruction it caused.
The EU estimates that about half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure has been destroyed, making the job of heating homes, hospitals, and schools increasingly difficult.
And in a related story, on Thursday, the White House announced that President Biden will meet with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House on Thursday, September 26th. Vice President Kamala Harris will meet with him separately. The leaders will discuss the state of war between Russia and Ukraine, including Ukraine's strategic planning and U.S. support for Ukraine as it defends against Russian aggression. According to the White House's statement, the president and vice president will emphasize their, quote, unshakable commitment to stand with Ukraine until it prevails in this war. Information released late Wednesday by U.S. intelligence officials indicate Iranian hackers not only tried to leak stolen Trump campaign documents to media organizations, but also tried to feed them to Biden campaign officials. For more, I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden.
Well, this is an effort by Iran to meddle in the U.S. presidential elections in November that's grown in scale and in scope. Initially, in mid-October, the Trump campaign announced it had been hacked, it had been attacked, and it put the blame on Iran. About a week later, the U.S. intelligence community confirmed that Iran was behind an operation it described as a hack and leak, where it got access to documents, internal documents for the Trump campaign, and then tried to peddle them to media organizations in an effort to hurt Trump's campaign and his re-election bid. Now, intelligence officials and investigators with the FBI are saying the plot by Iran was slightly more complicated. It was not only involving a hack and leak designed to damage Trump by releasing information to the media, but Iran also sought to ensnare the Biden campaign, and that in late June, early July, after Iran had already hacked the Trump campaign, it sent emails to a number of people associated with the Biden re-election campaign. Again, at the time, Biden was still running for president as a Democratic candidate. He'd not yet been replaced by Vice President Kamala Harris. And they tried to get the Biden campaign interested in this information, and they sent snippets, some text from the documents they stole to the Biden administration. The intelligence officials now say that Iran was trying to get more involved in this and to create a bigger mess, either to hurt the Trump campaign or to cause doubt about the American election and democratic process.
Is there any indication that the Biden campaign was aware of what was happening, where this information came from, how it was gotten?
According to intelligence officials and statements that they've put out, the Biden campaign did not respond. The individuals who were contacted by these proxies or cutouts for Iran did not respond to these emails. Obviously, they kept them. The intelligence community was able to take a look at them. But it still caused some reaction by the various campaigns. The Trump campaign put out a statement after this was announced saying that this shows that Iran is against Trump because he's going to be tough on Iran. But they also called on the Harris campaign to show that they're not colluding with Iran. Again, intelligence officials say there's no evidence that that's happened, and the Harris campaign put out a statement saying that they condemn what Iran did and that they are cooperating with intelligence agencies and law enforcement as they continue this investigation.
Do we know the content of the hacks? Do we know what kind of information the Iranians were trying to peddle to media and to the Biden campaign?
From what we understand, the information the Iranians got by hacking into the Trump campaign are internal campaign documents, stuff that, if released, you know, could shed light on some of the internal debates within the campaign, stuff that, you know, in the public could potentially embarrass the Trump campaign, embarrass former President Trump as he runs for re-election.
VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, thanks for your reporting on this.
Anytime.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London with Steve Karish in Washington.
Updates on elections in Kashmir and tuberculosis in South Africa coming up. First, though, the Indo-Pacific.
President Joe Biden on Saturday hosts the leaders of Australia, India, and Japan for his final convening of the so-called Quad, a strategic security grouping focused on the Indo-Pacific area, a populous and economically vital region also of strategic interest to China. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
The White House says President Joe Biden has made it a priority to elevate the relationship of the Quad countries, India, Japan, Australia, and the U.S., by hosting their leaders for Saturday's summit. All four countries touch the Indo-Pacific region. That region stretches from the U.S. Pacific shores to the oceans surrounding India, to the waters around Japan, to Australia, and the many tiny diffuse islands of the Pacific. And the administration says this summit is personally important to Biden, who hosts them at his Delaware home. Karine Jean-Pierre is White House Press Secretary.
This leaders' summit will focus on bolstering the strategic convergence among our countries, advancing our shared vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific region, and delivering concrete benefits.
And that the four will make an announcement on curbing illegal fishing. Kurt Campbell is U.S. Deputy Secretary of State.
Vast majority of those fishing fleets are Chinese. We think these capacities will be indeed very helpful in helping local governments repel illegal fishing in their home waters.
Analysts say this is more than a swan song for a retiring leader. Biden likes to say that the U.S. is at an inflection point, a fact he has stressed as American voters face a major fork in the road in November's election. The two presidential contenders disagree on how to maintain the crucial U.S.-China relationship. Republican challenger Donald Trump seeks hard tariffs.
I'm putting a 200% tariff on, which means...
Vice President Kamala Harris is likely to echo Biden's approach to a relationship that impacts many other nations and diplomatic connections worldwide. Analysts also say that pulling the leaders of four powerful democracies into one room gives them space to talk freely. Rafiq Dasani is a senior economist at the RAND Research Corporation and a professor of policy analysis.
So really, I think the real agenda is not spoken about. It's China. It's how to manage the rivalry with China. So that doesn't show up in the readout.
But China is not the leader's sole focus, analysts say. Catherine Pack of the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
This is certainly not a contained China club. The primary objectives of the Quad have focused on health, on delivering infrastructure needs, on enhancing countries' ability to monitor their maritime domains and their maritime resources, and on people-to-people ties.
The foursome gets back together Saturday. Anita Powell, Viewing News, Washington.
Tuberculosis is the second leading cause of death in South Africa, and it remains a critical public health issue in many countries. Over the past 6 years, the Beat Tuberculosis Study, conducted in South Africa, focused on children and pregnant women. It's revealed some promising new treatments. Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
These pills are part of a drug trial in South Africa that may help revolutionize tuberculosis therapy. A new regimen cured 85 to 90% patients with drug-resistant TB, up from 50% for previous regimens. Plus, the treatment worked for two key groups often left out of TB treatment research. Dr. Francesca Conradi led the study called Beat Tuberculosis.
We found safe and effective treatment for pregnant women and children, but also we've awakened the field to say, actually, this has to be done.
Women, children, and men in the Beat Tuberculosis trial all received the same regimen. That's a change from previous treatments, even though TB often affects entire families.
The daddy gets one easy regimen to take, and then the mom gets a more complicated one because she's pregnant, and the child gets an even more complicated one. Dad is cured after 6 months, mom is cured after 8 months, and we wait, or 9 months, we wait for 18 months for us to be able to know if the child is cured. So that's really an unfortunate set of circumstances.
The study shortened treatment of 6 months for everyone, and it did so without the harsh side effects of previous treatments. Dr. Pauline Howell supervised the study. She says the new regimen has the backing of the World Health Organization.
That basically means that countries can take the recommendation of the regimen and run with it, which is fantastic, because the more options we give countries to work with, the more options we can then translate to patients who need treatment.
Leslie Marbury is Southern African Mission Director for the United States Agency for International Development. She says breakthroughs like this new treatment could eventually pave the way for a world free of, or at least less troubled by, TB.
They're coming from high-burden countries like South Africa, who are motivated, then I feel confident that we can end tuberculosis as a global health challenge.
TB claims over 1 million lives each year, but experts say with early detection, simplified treatment regimens, and greater access to life-saving drugs, these deaths can be dramatically reduced. Sahir Kassim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
For the first time in over a decade, elections for 90 seats in the Indian-administered Kashmir's General Assembly are being held. This is the first vote since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government revoked the region's semi-autonomous status. Separatist leaders and parties are participating in the election against Modi's party. VOA's Yousef Jamil has more from Srinagar, Kashmir, narrated for us by Steve Miller.
Political campaigns are underway in Srinagar as voting for the first phase of the 90-member General Assembly of Indian-administered Kashmir begins this week. The region has been under New Delhi's direct rule since the collapse of the alliance between the region's People's Democratic Party and India's ruling BJP in 2018, followed by the Modi government's repeal of Article 370, which had granted its semi-autonomous status for decades. This is the first major election being held in Jammu and Kashmir since Article 370's revocation. Many candidates in the race are separatists and have openly called for restoring Kashmiri autonomy or outright independence from India. Their participation in electoral politics is seen by some analysts as political opportunism. However, these groups reject this view, attributing their shift to the evolving socio-political climate. Syed Salim Gilani, a former Kashmiri separatist leader, says it is neither a change of heart nor a compulsion. Demands change with time, he says, including the political urges of the people. Talat Majid is a former member of the separatist Jamaat-e-Islami party. He says that some people ask if there's been an ideological shift. He says he wants to tell them it's a political shift. Whenever you talk about Kashmir, he says, you need to think about the impact of the geopolitical scenario on it. Keeping that geopolitical scenario in view, you ought to think internationally, but act locally when it comes to the Kashmir issue. Unfortunately, he says, our elders used to think locally, but act internationally. While various political candidates want to restore the region's autonomy, political observers and constitutional experts like Nur Ahmad Baba say that's not likely. Baba points out that Jammu and Kashmir is still a federally controlled territory. He says New Delhi recently vested more powers to the lieutenant governor, who was also the region's top executive. This scenario, he says, may not be possible for a regional party if voted to power to do much towards fulfilling the promise of bringing the limited autonomy back. But Baba points out that a vote for autonomy candidates sends a message to New Delhi. Many Kashmiris want back many of the freedoms they enjoyed under autonomy, a constitution, flag, and legal privileges. So far, the Modi government has already ruled out restoring the region's previous status. For Yousef Jamil and Zubair Dar, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
The U.S. Senate is preparing a temporary spending bill that would avert a partial shutdown of the government. Congress must pass spending legislation before the start of the new fiscal year on October 1st to avoid furloughing thousands of federal workers and shutting down a wide swath of government operations weeks before the November 5th election. A bill that would have paired 6 months of funding with controversial election law changes opposed by Democrats failed in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives on Wednesday.
And that ends today's program, but there is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Steve Karish and all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.